welcome to Women on the Margins, Incarceration and Resistance. So I'm really glad that you're all here. I'm Diana Block. I'm going to play a dual role today. I'm going to try and facilitate this this panel, which we really, really hope is going to be interactive and not just us talking. But I am also going to be one of the presenters, so this is a goes against certain rules, but that's okay. So, so the other thing I want to say in advance is some of the panelists who were originally supposed to be on this panel are not, and I'm really sorry for that. You know, we had to line up the panelists way months and months ago, and then their schedules changed. So Pilar from Critical Resistance and Joanne from Immigrant Defense Network and Susan Rosenberg, none of them are here. But we have an amazing group of people to speak on this issue, and so I hope that that their absence will be felt, but not severely. So, so I will just briefly introduce the panelists. Myself, I'll start with, I'm Diana Block. I'm one of the founding members of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, which has been in existence since 1995, continuously. And I'm also the recent author of a new book called Arm the Spirit, which has information about women prisoners and work around women prisoners, as well as many other things. So, and starting on my right is Vicki Law, and she is the author of a new book called Women's Resistance Behind Bars. I know the general name, but the exact titles sometimes are a little hard. Yes, there, Laura is being very helpful and handy. Right, yes. And she also is one of the founders of Books Through Bars, which is a group that sends literature into prisoners around the country, and it's run out of Blue Stockings bookstore. And finally, she is the author of she's one of the editors of a magazine called Tenacious, Writings of Women Prisoners. So, and she'll tell you more about her background. Then we have Sophia Elijah, who is the deputy director of the Harvard Law School Criminal Justice Institute. She's also a human rights attorney, and she has defended many, many political prisoners, women and men, and currently is heavily involved in the case of the San Francisco 8, which is former Black Panthers who are now facing trial in San Francisco. And the lawyer for political prisoner Marilyn Buck, who has been incarcerated for many years, but she has been representing her, and hopefully we're looking forward to her being released in another year and a half, which is just fantastic. Yes?
I have a request. If someone could please enlarge letters, write the ISBNs for all the books.
Oh, okay. Can we do that a little later? Or
there are also cards that we could give
cards,
you.
Cards, yeah. Maybe we can...
postcards that have the information.
Yeah.
Would
so,
that do it?
Yeah. But thank you for your request. That is...
Diana, I don't have one for you.
Yeah, I don't... Where I had them, but it's going to take me a minute to locate where I put
yes.
them. Yes, my card. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So those, yeah, we could just pass some of those around. Anyway, and then, helpfully over here, is Laura Whitehorn.
Being helpful.
Yes, and that's... And she is a former political prisoner who did over 14 years in state and federal institutions. She is a dedicated advocate for political prisoners, has been part of many different organizations that work for political prisoners since she has been released and while she was still in prison. And she is also an editor at POS Magazine, which is a magazine dedicated to covering issues of HIV and AIDS, and she has focused about on the issue of HIV in prison. So, this is our illustrious panel. Yes?
Is Laura the only one of the panel who was in jail?
Yes, at this point. Yes, that was one of the, we had hoped to have more former prisoners as part of this, but that is what hasn't, and we, hasn't happened, so. So, to begin with, what we wanted to do, just to give you a sense of what the overview, I just wanted to say a few words about the framing of this panel, why we think this panel is important in the framework of this conference. And then each of our presenters is going to talk a little bit about their experience with resistance of women in prison. And then we're going to have a series of questions, which I'm going to ask the presenters to comment on, and then I'm going to open up after each question to the participants to either comment yourselves on the issue or ask further questions on a specific topic. And then we're going to go through that, and then we're going to hopefully wrap up at the end and talk about future steps and, get more and circulate resources and things like that. Okay, any questions about the format? Great. So, one of the reasons we really wanted to do this panel is because we feel like the issues of both incarceration in general and within that women prisoners is marginalized within the left and within many of the kinds of conferences where people examine the big issues. Somehow the issue of incarceration and women prisoners doesn't figure into that picture, and yet we feel like it is very significant, and it isn't something that you can just give a token appreciation or, yes, there are prisoners, there are prisons in this country, over 2.3 million of them, and that's something to the side. So, and the fact that women have been the fastest growing sector of the prison population, and that the overwhelming number of those women are women of color, is also something that is neglected, even though that speaks to a very important aspect of why incarceration and women is significant. So we're trying to recenter it. We're trying to give information that will help you all understand why it is important to talk about women's incarceration. And then more than that, we really want to talk about the resistance of women in prison, because often when the media does focus on women in prison, usually it's to talk about how their victimization and how they are victims and their suffering, all of which I would have to agree is true, but really undermines the levels to which women also have taken steps to challenge the terms of their incarceration and to really raise significant questions and battles against what has happened to them and us in the past 15, 20 years in terms of the increase in incarceration. That's another aspect that we want to really talk about. And then I think we want to explore how this fits with the general picture of economic collapse in this country. I mean, especially when you look at it in that framework, you really, I don't think, can see incarceration in this, as a marginal issue, or the incarceration of women as marginal. So we did want to try and relate it to the larger themes of the conference. So that's the framework, and we want to start, though, with talking about the experience of the different presenters with the issue, and I think we're going to start with Laura, who's someone who knows it firsthand on the inside.
Yes, both sides. I mean, I have to say, I do think that in my experience, the imprisonment of women in this country amounts to genocide, a form of genocide. One part of genocide in the international definition is to put a cap on populations and to destroy families and to destroy communities from within. That's what the incarceration of women in massive numbers and for crimes that really are, you know, way, the sentences way out of proportion, and all of that. And the number, when I was in prison, it was the beginning of the explosion of the population of Latina women who were immigrants and were on immigration, you know, offenses or something. And the other largest population, of course, was African American women. People were, you know, because there are fewer, the prisons were built when there were fewer women in prison. In the federal system, which is where I ended up, people were thousands and thousands of miles from their children. These are families that don't have huge resources, and so people were unable, some women were unable to see their children for years and years while they were. But, okay, so I'm not going to talk about that side of it that much. I just want to say I was arrested in 1985, and if anyone is curious about my case, I can tell you later. It was a political case, a left-wing political case. And so that's important, I think, to know, because my experience in prison was always colored by that. First of all, even though I hated being in prison and wanted to get out and tried many times through, you know, different means, I never had that kind of sense of, oh, my life is over, because I was still fighting to be part of the movement. The second thing I want to say that's sort of a general overview thing is that inside prison, all the contradictions of this society remain. So racism, sexism, obviously, homophobia. But what that meant for a white prisoner was that my consciousness had to continue, and that, you know, I was in Baltimore City Jail the first year I was arrested. Well, the guards in Baltimore City Jail were all black, and they were all from fairly poor backgrounds, and they had taken the job because it was, you know, probably the only halfway decent paying job that they could get. And so that always colored my relationship to the staff, whereas in the federal system where the cops are much more, they're, you know, government employees and they're middle class, it just is a different way of combating, you know, fighting for your rights. But what I want to talk about is when I got arrested in Baltimore City Jail, which is one of the poorest jails in the country, where they couldn't even give anyone any clothes to wear, so that women who were arrested for sex work crimes in August would come in hot pants and you know, spandex, and they'd be still wearing it in December when there was no heat in the prison. So that gives you a picture. And I think what I want to say about it is that the first thing that struck me there was that I was in a community of women. And so, you know, even though women's prisons are worse than men's in terms of resources and stuff, I'd much rather be in a women's prison than a men's, because women, our form of first form of resistance is to form communities. And I think Vicky talks about that in her book. Everything I've been going to say, Vicky touches on in her book. And so for me, it was very important to explain who I was and what I was doing there. And that was very interesting. And I made friends very quickly. And people defied the guards who said, don't talk to her, she's dangerous. You know, and people immediately said, oh, really? You know, talk to me. And what I learned there, a very important lesson, which in terms of resistance. Well, first of all, I learned that I was going to have to resist the whole time I was in prison, because otherwise I would be just, you know, disempowered utterly. That I wasn't going to, no one was going to give me what I was, quote, entitled to by the jail regulations, the Constitution, international law. No, it was not that kind of authority. But what I had to learn that was really important for me was the difference between getting furious because as a white middle-class woman, I really hate waiting on lines. No, I mean, really, I'm going to make fun of myself here for a minute, but, you know, I didn't want to. And the difference between that and making that an issue, which no one else there thought was the big issue, and fighting for things that were really important to people, and also taking leadership from the women who knew better than I did what was important to resist. So I'll just give this one example. The first, I was there, the food there was horrible. By the time I went to court, 3 months after being there, I weighed 89 pounds, and the marshals started spreading the rumor that I had cancer because they couldn't understand why I lost so much weight, but there was nothing to eat. I was living on apples and pretzels. Not bad, actually. And I understood why, you know, I hated Ronald Reagan, but, you know, sometimes ketchup is a vegetable. I hate it. We had been, you know, sort of hoping that at Thanksgiving we would get, like, a piece of turkey, you know, something that was decent. And so comes Thanksgiving, and they hand out these, in the meeting place, they hand out these, I don't know, they were dinosaur legs. You know, you could break a window with them. And in this prison, I have to say, when you would come in, if you had dentures, they would take your teeth away. So most of the women didn't have teeth. And so I couldn't eat it with my big choppers, and other women couldn't either. So we were all furious. We marched out, we threw them all in the garbage, and, you know, walked out. And that was the first little bit of resistance around this issue. So, of course, with my, like, oh, we're going to make a revolution here, I started talking to my friends. And we formed an inmate council, which, you know, of course, was never listened to. And I said, at Christmas, let's do a hunger strike, you know, let's throw the trays back at them or something like that. And people were like, no, we don't want to do that, What they came up with, which was much better, was that we should not go to dinner that day, just not go, and that we should organize the community people who came in, which was like 3 people, a nun, a teacher, and another chaplain, and the decent guards to bring food and make a Christmas party. And so we got that. And the whole time I'm thinking, oh yeah, this is really revolutionary Christmas party. Well, it was, because it was saying, fuck you, you don't want to give us our rights, but we're going to take them in this small way, and it was the most wonderful thing. It was really great. So that was one example. I got moved after that to Lexington, FCI Lexington, which now is for men and doesn't exist quite in the same way, but at that point was the largest. Am I talking too long?
No.
It was the largest federal prison for women, and it was also the federal hospital unit. And at that point, all prisoners, women prisoners from D.C., were sent to Lexington because there was no long-term prison for women in D.C. So they were either sent down to Lorton in Virginia, or they were sent to the federal system, and most of them were in the federal system, which meant that it was a very different population because the federal system is a higher class of crime. You know, it's like white-collar crime and stuff, and local jails, city jails, are more the smaller drug crimes as opposed to the big leagues, you know, the leaders of the cartels. So, and AIDS had struck. And this was when women didn't get AIDS, right? You know, it was just an immense disease. No one was paying attention, but all the women around me were dying. And so one of our biggest resistances there was to demand that we get the right to organize for AIDS and to do AIDS work and to go into the hospital, which is off limits, to be with the women who were dying. And that was at the point where, I mean, in addition to the issue of women in prison being marginalized in the left, I would have to say I think the issue of HIV/AIDS is marginalized in the left. And if it's talked about at all, it's talked about globally, which is very important. I mean, certainly we're going to fight the U.S. government around justice. Fighting for decent care for people around the world with HIV/AIDS is important. But the fact that in this country no one looks at it as a social issue, as an issue. Should we fight homophobia? Yeah, we fight homophobia. Okay, that shows up in AIDS. Do we fight racism? Yes, okay, you know, et cetera. So just a side note. The big thing at Lexington that I'll get to is that it was the most locked-down, militarized place that I had ever been. You could only wear exactly what they told you could wear. You had to walk at a certain pace on one side of the hall, and, you know, there was controlled movement. You had 10 minutes to get anywhere. in between this hour when everything was locked down, and if you didn't make it, you went to the hole because you weren't at work on time or whatever. And you were constantly searched, and you were constantly pat searched by male guards, which is true in all the federal systems. Women are pat searched by male guards. And as a lesbian, I found this utterly, utterly infuriating, as you can tell, because I can't talk about it without getting angry. And so there were all these things at Lexington that I kept trying to get people, my friends, who were very rebellious, you know, steal, yes, we would steal from the kitchen, break the rules, but to actually organize to do something was very difficult. Then Rodney King, the verdict for Rodney King came in, the Simi Valley white jury that said that just because Rodney King had been beaten mercilessly by the cops in full sight of the entire American population didn't mean the cops had to go to prison. And the response among the women prisoners, all of us, was fury because, you know, it was utter injustice and racism. And we started out doing little sort of stickers, which we stole from one of the business offices, and we put them on walls, and they got taken down right away. But now we kept trying to get something to happen, and people just were, you know, everyone was grumbling, but no one. Then one night, there was a large group of Haitian prisoners in the prison at that point, and there was a very strong community. And there were about 20 or 30 Haitian women hanging out in the central area of the prison, which was called Central Park. And there was an argument, vocal argument, and a lieutenant came running after the argument was over, and just out of meanness, he jumped a woman, threw her to the ground, and put her hands behind her back and dragged her off to the hall. She was not even in the argument. And the Haitian community there got very angry about this. And because there was a group that was leading, the next day we finally did what we had been wanting to do for a long time, because we just refused to go in for count. The 4 o'clock count in the federal system is, you know, God. You don't go to 4 o'clock count if you're not standing straight, whatever it is, that's a big crime. So there were only 100 of us who did it, because a lot of people wanted to but were frightened. But once we did it, the next day there was another group that did it. There were people set fires in the units during count. It was, you know, it was quite a scene. And we got shipped off to another prison right away. But for me, having been an activist since I was 20 years old and having been in a lot of demonstrations and takeovers and all kinds of things, having gone to jail many times, it was the most revolutionary moment of my life, because it was people who had a lot to lose. That what they had to lose was a little bit of nothing that they had. And that little bit of nothing in prison, you think, oh, you know, prison, you're going to rebel because you have nothing. Well, when you have nothing, the one little bit of something you have is more important. So I'll leave that one for a minute. Yeah, wrap up. Okay, so I just want to say that why I think it's really important for people to take this issue is that women are marginalized by the left. They're also marginalized by the society in general, which means that there are many more programs in men's prisons for the most part, although Bedford Hills Prison in New York is the one exception that proves the rule, than there are for women. And so if activists and human rights activists on the outside don't struggle for and try to change that, like with the programs that Vicky has done, for example, or the CCWP, then, you know, our sisters inside are just abandoned. So, sorry.
Great. No.
Anybody else questions?
Can we elect the presenters? I mean, if there's one very specific thing.
Yeah, actually, there is.
Okay.
Laura, were you ever molested by any of the male guards?
Yeah, actually, there was a pat search. There was this one guy, we called him John Wayne, at Lexington. And you have to, okay, Lexington, Kentucky, Klan country at that point, white guards. There were maybe 2 black guards in the whole prison, and the population was mostly black. And the lesbians were known. I mean, it was, you know, it was a little hard to miss, and also, so I was out. A lot of people were just out because that was their life. He would pat search us. They're not supposed to put their hands on your breasts or, you know, in between your legs. They're supposed to sort of go around the areas. They're supposed to go like this. And he grabbed my breasts and squeezed them. And so I just automatically, I rammed my elbow into whatever was nearest behind me. And he tried to lock me up, you know, I was taken to the lieutenant's office. And at that point, one of the other dykes on the compound, who was a good friend of mine, saw me. And I said, John Wayne, just grabbed my breast and blah, blah. And so she brought two others, and we all, they stood outside the lieutenant's office, off limits. And they said, we demand that this be taken seriously. And so they didn't lock me up. They did give me a shot, but a shot is a write-up in the federal system, and usually, you know, it's like a charge. It's a criminal charge. But they didn't charge me with assault, which is what I thought they were going to do, because that is an assault. Touching a guard, you know, is an assault. And the reason they didn't was that actually they knew that he had been doing this, but they had been letting it go. And we then briefed it, you know, we all briefed it, we went through all the processes and everything, and we lost. They said he had acted professionally. But the lieutenant, all of a sudden they had brought in this other lieutenant from another institution because they were afraid that the racism that was going on around the Simi Valley thing and all that was you know, stirring things up. So they brought in a black lieutenant who was actually a really decent guy. And so after we lost and that's why I wasn't locked up, and that's why I wasn't charged with assault because of him. And after we lost the grievance, he took two of us aside and he said, we want you to know that they're making John Wayne watch the training videos over and over again. And they didn't have him at the checkpoint where the most people get. He had done it to three other women. But can I tell one other quick story? In the feds at Dublin, this story is real. They, you know, you get UA'd all the time in the feds. You have to give urine samples to see if you're using drugs, you know. And it's done almost random. You have to do it every few months. And generally, it's fairly humiliating. You have to, you know, have a guard in there standing watching you and all that stuff. But this one system, and in the federal system, it all goes by who's in charge, right? So this one captain was in charge at Dublin at one point. This is years ago, before the recent Dublin. He had said that it was okay for the guards to make women strip, so that to make sure they weren't hiding anything that they could pour into the urine to magically make the dope disappear. Strip and pee naked in front of the guards. Well, this one guard took it further and made these women pee with one leg up like a fucking dog. Oh. And I didn't know about this. One day, my cellmate, who was this wonderful, wonderful woman whom I adored, came back from the captain's office and she was crying. And I'd never seen her cry. And so she told me what had happened. And so I marched to the unit manager's office and I started to throw a fit. The unit manager was a woman. Anyway, we did grieve it and we won again. But that's an example. The thing about it that I wanted to say is that it happened to at least 20 women who wouldn't say, it's like rape. They wouldn't tell that it had happened to them because it was so humiliating. And so to create resistance in women's prison, you have to overcome that too, because they thought, you know, it's like being raped. You think it's your fault. So it was one of the most, actually, I forgot about that.
That's just one quick. Yeah. Were you molested by other
women? This shit about women and rape by other women prisoners in prison. I'm not getting ready either. It's bullshit. It's utter bullshit. The one time that it was, well, maybe it happens some places, but
it does happen some places.
What I should say is the blowing it the blowing out of proportion is bullshit. It does happen.
And it's set up often when in my knowledge of it, it's set up by the guards.
Right.
I mean, so in that
sense.
Right.
I
just think you can't say it never happens, but it's part of the manipulation that the guards do in terms of like buying off some women, that they do try and set up to assault other people. But it's few and far between.
Exactly.
Thank you, Laura. So let's go next, Sophia, would you like to?
Sophia, are you comfortable holding this? Or would you like me to? Or do you want with the bureau?
Do you want to sit here?
It's just for radio. I'm sorry, it's not really projecting, but it'll get the voices further if you want. Thank you. Well,
First, of course, I want to say thank you for inviting me to participate in the panel. And it's really cool to be on the panel with these amazing women, some of whom I've known a long time. I'm not going to tell the years. As I was preparing my remarks for today, and it's not all going to be academic, despite my employer, one of the things that I found really disturbing, because I went to the Bureau of Justice Statistics to start off gathering some information that I thought would be relevant, contemporary. And I must say, I was stunned to find that the most recent statistics were from 1998 on women in prison. That was really sad. So, I mean, to really highlight how much the larger society doesn't care, the fact that the Bureau of Justice Statistics that has almost up-to-the-minute records on the incarceration of people, they can tell you, like, almost to the tens, how many people are locked up. But when it came to specific statistics about women, the most recent information that they have online is 1998. So forgive me for being 10 years plus behind in some of what I'm going to share with you. So in 1998, 3.2 million arrests of women occurred. And that was about 22% of the adult arrests. So that was in 98. And the figures are much worse now. So the kinds of increases that we're seeing are this, and the most significant increase is amongst juvenile women, which is particularly disturbing. The ages of 18 to 24 are particularly vulnerable. So in 1998, the number of juvenile women being arrested was 2 times the rate of adult women per capita being arrested. So we're taking a whole generation. And sensitizing or desensitizing them to having their liberty taken away at what their childbearing, maturing, family bearing, all of the, you know, getting into being an acceptable citizen, voting, etc., all that's being wiped out at that very young age. So since 1990, the number of women defendants convicted of felonies in state courts has grown at more than twice the increase for men, more than twice. The types of backgrounds that most of the women coming into the criminal injustice system have is troubling in and of itself, and it indicates that the majority of them needed intervention, social work intervention, to help them with the kinds of things that I'm going to share with you. So, for instance, 6 out of the 10 women in state prisons report that they had experienced physical and or sexual abuse in the past prior to their incarceration. 6 out of 10. I can tell you as a criminal defense lawyer, the overwhelming majority of the people, men and women, coming through the system don't get any kind of social work intervention. They already come into the system with serious social work needs, and they get very little assistance while they are incarcerated. Certainly nothing sufficient to address their issues so that when they come out, they don't find themselves further behind the eight ball. Just over 1/3 of the imprisoned women had been abused in an intimate relationship in the past prior to their incarceration. Small wonder, then, that we turn to what are the types of crimes that women are being arrested and incarcerated for. 1 out of 7 violent offenders throughout the U.S. are women. 1 out of 7. And amongst women between the ages of 18 to 24, the per capita rate for committing murder increased between 95 and 97. So across the United States, the arrest rate for murders have decreased, but for women, it has increased. Now, I'm not going to bore you with too many statistics, but I think that it's important to understand what the landscape is of the women population, and then put into context where political prisoner, political women resistance inside the prisons falls. In 1998, there were 951,900 women who were either under the care, custody, or control of the adult criminal justice authorities. one in 109 adult women were under some kind of supervision 11 years ago. Okay? So it's much worse now. Women were 16% of the corrections population in 98. In 98, between 90 and 98, the number of women involved in the criminal justice system increased by 48%. Compare that to 27% for men during the same time period. In some respects, we might say that America kind of got bored with locking up men, and the next group was women. I guess there's nobody left after that. Well, and the numbers are very, very, very disturbing. The number of women incarcerated between 90 and 98 increased by over 88% in just 8 years. And then we come to the racial disparities. And earlier there was some discussion about genocide, and I could not agree with you more. So for people, for women on probation, two-thirds of the women on probation are white. Two-thirds of the women incarcerated are minorities. It could not be more glaring. And for Hispanic women, one out of seven are in state custody, and one in three in federal custody are Hispanic. One in three. And we already know Hispanic women don't begin to represent one-third of the U.S. population. Interestingly, more than 50% of the incarcerated women have finished high school, as opposed to men, the overwhelming majority of whom come into the system having not completed the 10th grade. The last part of the statistics that I want to share with you is this. 11 out of 1,000 women can expect, or could expect in 98, to be incarcerated during their lives. Out of every 1,000, 11. The statistics for white women were that 5 out of every 1,000 could expect to be incarcerated during the course of their lives. For black women, the statistics were 36 out of every 1,000 could expect to be incarcerated during the course of their lives. And for Hispanic women, 15 out of every 1,000. The numbers tell the story. They really, really do. So in that background, we have women like Laura and so many other political prisoner women coming into the prisons with a much, I'll say, broader worldview. But they're encountering the majority of a population that is subjected to the things that I just described to you in very stark racist situations, having been abused, many of whom have been involved in violence. We haven't even touched the surface of drug involvement, using, alcohol abuse, etc. Most, not all, political prisoners have been sentenced to far longer sentences than, quote unquote, the social prisoner. So, for instance, if you look at the women who were sentenced as part of the Move 9, and I don't know, I imagine, does everybody here know who Move 9 are? Okay, that's a yes. They got multiple life sentences, even though the judge could not discern who was responsible for what crime. He just sentenced everybody the same. Marilyn Buck was sentenced in her first incarceration, her first sentence, 10 years for buying 10 boxes of ammunition. A charge for which most people would just get probation. The conditions under which women are incarcerated and political prisoners are incarcerated are much worse. So, for instance, for Asada Shakur, She was held as the only woman in an all-men's prison. Male guards, all male prisoners, and so she's put in an isolation unit all by herself. And no judge thought there was any problem with her status of incarceration. And then we look at what happened after September 11th, 2001. Marilyn Buck, who was doing time in Dublin, who has not had a disciplinary shot the entire time, as this is how fast this happened. As the second plane was hitting the World Trade Center, she was snatched off her unit and put in the hole. Not for violating any rules, she was held incommunicado, no access to friends, family, lawyers, by visit, mail, or phone call for many weeks. The same thing was done to other male political prisoners, and no explanation was given as to why they were thrown in a hole, except that it was for their security. Now, I'll be the first to tell you that nobody in prison generally relies on the guards for their security, and the political prisoners definitely don't. So the irony and the hypocrisy of it all is pretty stark. There are many, many women who did time. Perhaps the first, well, I shouldn't say the first, but one of the most known is Lolita Lebron out of the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. Okay? And then we had the next wave of Puerto Rican political prisoners, which I'll try to remember to name everybody. Aide, Carmen, Dilcia, Lucy, Alicia, Alejandrina. Did I get everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. And then we had North American political prisoners, Laura Susan Rosenberg, Sylvia Baraldini, Marilyn Buck, Judy Clark, Kathy Boudin, Linda Evans, Kathy Wilkerson, Rosemary McFadden, and I believe I may have missed a couple, but they found themselves buried in these prisons. And for the Puerto Rican women, but for Clinton literally letting them out, changing their sentences, they probably would still be in. Haide is still in. And then there was Asada, who I mentioned earlier, who they just buried in the prison. And but for the beauty of November, we'll get the date, 1979, November 3rd, 1979, where some beautifully audacious men, black men, went into Clinton prison and said, enough is enough. And she resulted in having political asylum in Cuba, she would still be buried in some dungeon here in the United States. I think I'm probably almost out of time. So I'm gonna wrap up and say, for me, it's been a very personally fulfilling experience to spend the overwhelming majority of my career working on behalf of political prisoners and getting to know so many fabulous political prisoners, women and men alike. Of course, my journey with Marilyn Buck has been since 1985. I started representing Marilyn when my son was 5 months old, my oldest son. He is now 24. So we have a way beyond the attorney-client relationship, shall we say. I can't think of anything more rewarding to do, but more importantly than how rewarding it is, how important it is for all of us to take up this task and change this system. I won't speak about how.
Okay, now Vicki.
Okay, so my experience is with starting to do prisoner work and prison abolition work is very different than Laura's and Sophia's. My experience started when I was a teenager, and a lot of my friends had dropped out of schools to join gangs. And my first experiences with prison is when they started going to jail and to prison. And that coupled with starting to reach outside of like my usual school circles and learning about radical politics, and especially works talking about the abolition of prison. What is wrong with prison? What is the function of prison? You know, why is it there? Led me to realize that it wasn't just that they had done these fucked up things They had done these things, and, you know, like,
TV, so you can say it. It's okay.
They had done these things, and they went to prison, and, you know, like, it was sort of like, you did a bad thing, you will be punished, but that there was this whole system that set up certain classes of people, certain socioeconomic and certain racial classes, to basically jail and go to prison. So when you're growing up in a working class, immigrant background, you're seeing your parents bust their butts, you know, like working two or three jobs and really not getting anywhere. You're going to a high school that is basically more like a prison than a high school. You're not learning anything, and somebody says, "You want to make a couple of $100 a night?" You say, "Great." So they slowly, one by one, or not so slowly, started going to jail and to prison.
You can use your hands.
Thank you. And I started doing support work for them. It was basically like going to Rikers Island, going to visit them upstate, bringing them reading material, whatever book I had finished reading, and also seeing how they devoured this, like opportunities that they hadn't had on the outside or things that they wouldn't have looked at on the outside became really, really interesting to them on the inside. And they started thinking and analyzing about the things that had led them to prison and, like, the reasons why they were going to prison and what was going on the outside that, you know, had contributed to this. At the same time, I was also becoming more involved with radical politics, partially because I started seeing this as something that I wanted to be involved with, and also because it spoke to what my experiences were in terms of, you know, incarceration, jail, you know, like, what was going on around me in terms of, like, a lot of racist treatment by the police, you know, like being a teenager growing up in New York, you know, like hanging out with like groups of kids of color without any money, hanging out in the streets, being hassled by the police. So, as I said, I started getting involved with radical politics. I started getting involved with people who were doing prison abolition work. There was a chapter of the Anarchist Black Cross, which is a group that does work for political prisoners set up in New York at the time. They were doing work with political prisoners and social prisoners who were doing political work. And with them, I started reaching out to people who were organizing in prison. Most of these people were men, which is something that I didn't quite realize until later. So it would be people doing, you know, having political study groups in the prison, you know, reading about radical politics, people who, again, hadn't had this opportunity on the outside to do that. It was people organizing against the management control unit from within in the men's prison in Trenton. And again, like I said, this was all like work being done with and through other groups on the outside. I also started a chapter of Books Through Bars, which is a group that sends free books to prisoners here in New York, basically seeing how my friends had really devoured all this reading material. And when people said, you know, we think that this would be an important group to start, I jumped right in and helped start that. Then I went to college and, you know, studied some things, and one of the things that I did was I wanted to do some research on post-Attica prisoner organizing, because I wasn't really finding that in what I was reading and what I was studying. So I did a paper, I did, you know, a semester or a year's worth of research of what was already out there. So I relied on books, magazines, periodicals, anarchist zines, and at the end of this, I looked at what I had, and I was like, wow, this is all men. You know, like maybe with the exception of like the piece that you wrote about the standout in Lexington and one other piece, it was all men. And I said, where are the women in this? And so I started asking people who had been doing prisoner support for long periods of time, people from the Anarchist Black Cross, people from Medgar-Evers College, you know, people who had been doing work with social prisoners and political prisoners and, you know, politicized prisoners. And almost everybody said to me, women don't organize. You know, this is why you're not finding anything, because it doesn't exist. And I didn't feel like that could be the case, because there's so much organizing going on outside of women. So I said, okay, well, let me start again. Let me, like, erase everything that, like, I've learned about what resistance looks like, what activism looks like, what we think of when we think about organizing, and let me start from, like, the ground up. And I really wanted to focus on women who weren't political when they went in, but I wanted to focus on people, you know, who might have gotten caught up in the war on drugs, or might have gotten caught up in mandatory home sentences, women who had been incarcerated for killing their abusers, women who were not necessarily going to just go in and be like, I'm going to start the revolution in prison, but people who were, you know, who might have been me, you know, going in and being like, wait, you know, this can't be happening. I'm not putting up with this for the rest of my life. I don't think other people should. So what I started learning was that a lot of times women's needs are different from those of men's. Like, in some cases, everybody experiences the same crappy healthcare, and gender you know, exacerbates these conditions. So while everybody has bad health care or almost little to no health care in prison, when you're a woman and you have very gender-specific needs, like OBGYN, being pregnant, family histories of breast cancer, cervical cancer, lumps in your breast, prisons aren't set up to deal with that, and they don't want to deal with that, and they'll keep passing the buck, and they'll keep ignoring it, basically until you die, you know, or you sue the hell out of them, and then 10 years later you might get some small result. So what I found out is that sometimes there were cases in which gender was, gender and incarceration was just like an exacerbation of the really crappy prison conditions. And in other cases, their issues were actually really gendered, like sexual assault by staff members, as opposed to this idea that only prisoners assault other prisoners. And what were women doing around this? Like, you know, so I had to like look at that as, you know, if we're going to be talking about sexual assault, how does this happen in women's prisons? How does this specifically affect women, especially given that so many women have experienced previous abuse before they were arrested, either as children and or as adults? In addition, over 80% of women who go to prison are mothers of children under 18, and it seems like there is not any sort of like any agency that actually collects the statistic, because women don't want to say if they have children under the age of 18 when they get arrested, if they have somebody else to care for their children, because then that means that foster care can step in. And in 1997, under our wonderful President Clinton, the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed, stating that if a child has been in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state will automatically terminate parental rights. And this means that if you are incarcerated for any sort of mandatory minimum sentence, even if it's just like, you know, like 3 years, and you don't have somebody else that will take your child, and your child ends up in foster care, the state will automatically terminate rights. They can place the child for adoption, or the child will languish in foster care until he or she hits 18. That's 15 of the past 22 months. And that was actually a compromise. Yep. It's not based on any sort of...
And the state level, it's much worse.
By 12.
Within 48 hours, if you can't find a family member, they put them into foster care.
But they can't terminate
parental rights.
But this also isn't based on any sort of scientific evidence or study saying what is best for the child, like it's best if the child... one part of Congress wanted like 18 months, one part of Congress wanted 12 months, and 15 months was their compromise. So it wasn't even that like someday I had people come in that said, you know, under child development, blah, 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 blah. This was just a political compromise. What side wanted what.
I was going to say, you get a hearing, but the prison won't transport the parent to the hearing. So the court doesn't know why the parent's not there, so they just terminate it, and it's a default.
And this affects women more often than men, because oftentimes when fathers go to prison, there is a female, usually a female relative who will step up and take care of children. You know, if any of you know of Diana's story, you know, like when her partner went to prison, she was there for her children. Oftentimes when women go to prison, already they're single heads of household, or their partners are co-defendants, you know, or the partner's leaves. And so oftentimes there is not already somebody who will step up and take care of their children. So children of incarcerated mothers are 5 times more likely to go into foster care than children of incarcerated fathers, making this a much more gendered issue. And then because there are still relatively few women's prisons tend to be further from where their children were or where their families were living before they got arrested.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Sorry.
Speak up.
Okay. So looking at some of these issues, I realize that sometimes the forms of resistance are going to look very different and aren't recognized by people who are looking for resistance and organizing in sort of like the typical fashion. Like they're not always going to be work strikes or sit down demonstrations or hunger strikes or things that you can look at and be like, aha, this is what they did. So when I was looking for instances of resistance and organizing among women in prison, what I found were there were things like support groups for women who had been survivors of domestic violence, because there are so many more women who are incarcerated who have experienced previous physical and or sexual abuse. There are so many more women who are in prison for killing their abusers. In the statistic that you said about, I forget what the exact statistic was, of how many women are convicted of violent crimes or murder, there doesn't seem to be a delineation between women who kill in self-defense and women who just decide to go shoot somebody in the head at the 7-Eleven.
There isn't that distinction. There's nobody actually researching, or I don't want to say there's nobody researching. There has not been research that has come out publicly about who goes to prison for self, which women go to prison for self-defense, which ones have been killing their killed their abusers after many years of abuse, and which ones are just, you know, killing people who are not their intimate partners. But domestic violence support groups often haven't been noted as being legitimate activism or organizing, even in the cases in which these have led to women organizing in their prisons, organizing mass clemency campaigns. In Ohio in the 1980s, early 1990s, women in the Marysville Reformatory for Women organized a mass clemency campaign, which resulted in 25 women being freed by the governor. And this influenced women in California who had their own domestic violence support group to try their own mass clemency campaign with the governor then. The governor in California was a lot less inclined to let anybody out of prison, and so he only granted clemency to 3 of the, I forget, like 30 women who applied. But their actions had more far-reaching effects of interesting outside activists and advocates and lawyers in California to start doing work around women incarcerated for killing their abusers, and they formed a group called Free Battered Women, which 2 decades later is still in operation and is still working to get women incarcerated for killing their abusers out of prison. Again, this is not something that, you know, I found when I was looking for what was typically thought of prisoner activism and prisoner resistance, because people weren't recognizing that as activism and resistance. This seemed to be something that people looking at battered women's issues would look at, but people who are looking for, you know, like prison riots and prison work strikes weren't looking at. And women have also implemented programs to put incarcerated mothers and their children into contact. This has ranged from more formal things like the Children's Center at Bedford Hills, an hour and a half from here, where women have worked to create a children's center with the local, I think it's some sort of Catholic charity. But through that, they've also implemented a foster care committee, which tells women what their rights are when their children go to foster care. You know, which is super important, especially given the 1997 Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act. Because if women don't know what their rights are, like, they do have the right to a monthly visit. You know, no matter what your foster care worker tells you, you have a right to have that foster care worker bring your child up for a monthly visit. And this is something that you can use to influence your court case when the judge says, hey, your 15 months are up, I'm going to terminate your parental rights. You could say, well, I've been in contact with my child every month, which is especially important because contact is one of the things that makes a judge say, wait a minute, maybe I will postpone this determination of your rights. And there have also been less formal ways that women have organized. One woman in Florida surreptitiously wrote to every church, religious organization, parents' organization, everybody she could get an address for, to see if she could find somebody who would sponsor a bus to bring the children of herself, her children, and the children of 50 other women 300 miles from Miami to Tallahassee or Pullman or one of these places in northern Florida for a visit. And after 8 years of her writing to people and asking, you know, like, will you help sponsor a bus, risking getting a charge because you're not allowed to ask people on the outside to do things for you, to sponsor things, she finally managed to get an organization that said, we will pay for a bus. We'll take these children up there, their children and their caregivers, up to where you are, you and all these women are, and they will get a visit. And for some women, or for the majority of the women whose children came up, it was the first time in 10 years, or in over 10 years, that they had gotten to see their children. So if you go to, you know, prison when your child is 1 and suddenly your child is 11, but without that, they wouldn't have gotten that. And again, this was a form of resistance that I wasn't finding in the history books or in any of the political periodicals or journals or zines, because it wasn't seen as something that was like, you know, legitimate or political. And women have also helped each other in less formal ways, specifically around filing for legal issues. Thank you. Legal issues. As Sophia said, you know, like the literacy or the education level among women is very low. These are people who come from the lowest socioeconomic classes usually. They haven't had a good education, you know, like, oftentimes, like, if they go to high school, they probably go to a crap high school, like all of my friends did. In 2003, the Bureau of Justice Statistics had a report that said that 36% of women in prison, only 36% of women in prison had a high school diploma, but 42% of the women in prison had neither GEDs nor a high school diploma. And you mentioned that the majority of women hadn't even completed 10th grade. when they were on the outside. Of the men?
Oh, okay.
In 98, BJS was reporting that 50% of the women had completed high school, so it's gotten worse.
Okay, so it's gotten worse. So if you have women who don't know how to file legal paperwork and you have to file it a very specific way, they could misfile something and miss a deadline or miss, you know, a court case in which they could have, like, actually stayed or postponed a court's decision to terminate parental rights. So women with more formal education, either, you know, or informal education, have helped women with less education and less literacy levels in filing paperwork to keep custody of their children. So these were just some of the things that I saw when I was doing my research that made me think, wow, these are things that aren't being talked about when we're talking about prisoners, when we're talking about incarceration, when we're talking about resistance and activism and organizing inside the prisons.
Hey, thank you. Try and draw out a few things that haven't been touched on by other people. However, I just do want to, I mean, this workshop is entitled Women, Incarceration, and Resistance, and so there's a whole dimension of women, incarceration, resistance that has to do with the women and the family members who are outside and who are the networks and that really are critical for families inside prison. And so I was just told that Lydia, who is here with us, is Mumia's sister, and she is here. And so I just wanted to recognize her and ask her if she wanted to say a few words as a family member of somebody who has been really faced some of the harshest treatment in this country.
Peace, everybody.
Peace.
Thank you for this workshop. Thank you so much. It puts a new face on women for me. I have been shaken by seeing you and hearing you. Thank you for sharing, because this is the most powerful stuff I've heard. I am studying. I'm in school to be a master's in social work. And I've been studying children of incarcerated women. In a couple years, I did a lot of research on the children, and I saw the statistics about women in prison. And I'm like, oh, hell, what's going to happen to their children? You know, we got a whole community left, you know, with no parents, you know? And so I started change my studies to children. And I'm now working with children in the high school system. Currently, I'm working with ninth graders who are at high risk for dropout, but I didn't go to look at them for children of incarcerated parents, but found out of the 60 children, 22 had an incarcerated parent, you know, and those 22 children were not receiving any kind of supports. The statistics say children of incarcerated parents are more likely to go to jail. Children in foster care are very likely to drop out of high school. All of these children are at risk, and that's part of that pipeline to prison thing. So this, your speaking today is just bringing this all to point for me, and I thank you very much. So I'm going to stay with the children.
Okay.
I'm going to stay with the children because you're doing an excellent job with the women. In terms of my family, we're still here for Moo. We've been visiting him ever since he's been in prison. I go up personally every 3 months, which works for me. I have to fly. I cannot drive up there. But we try to keep that family connected. His daughter now lives in Florida. It's difficult for her to go back and forth, so I'm the go-between. But keeping family connected to the prison population, very, very important. Very important. Moo is very strong, but, you know, he needs that support. And sometimes when I go to visit him and he's in the closet, handcuffed behind the glass, and I walk in the door and we do the bump, you know, and we gossip about who we grew up with, who got pregnant, who, you know, who got drunk, and It's just a whole laugh. You know, we don't talk politics because everybody, I have to fight to get in between the politicians, not politicians per se, but people that are supporting him. So my time with him is just, excuse the expression, BS. You know? He needs BS, you know, because he's constantly working, trying to stay on task and stay focused. And when I leave, we're both laughing in tears, you know, and it's a good thing. So that's what I want to share.
I was thinking about this, even though it's not women in prison, when I was thinking about Vicky's book, I was thinking about Mumia has a new book out called Jailhouse Lawyers, and it's downstairs, it's for sale, and it's unbelievable. It's really amazing, and it'll give you a sense of prison if people really do want to know about what prison is. That's different from a description of what people do every day. It's just, it's a brilliant, brilliant book, and it's another subject, just like Vicky's book, it's the first on this subject, really, as far as I know.
Right.
Yeah. I just want to say that Lydia will be speaking at a workshop after this at from 3 to 5 in room 304 East with the Live from Death Row workshop with a former death row prisoner and some other folks.
Yeah.
So please come and hear Lydia at this next 3 to 5, 304 East, next slot. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's see. I have many different ways I can segue into the parts that I wanted to talk about. I'll just because it was just mentioned, one of the forms of resistance that many, many women take up is to become jailhouse lawyers. I mean, there are so many women who I know and who've educated themselves and have the most extensive understanding of the law, and who not only, and who certainly don't only use it for their own cases, but become resources for all the other women in the jails and prisons across California, across the country. So this is another important form of resistance, and I know Mumia's book talks about the contradictions that on the one hand you're working within the system, the legal system, which is stacked against prisoners and people of color in this country, and yet using what you can, what you learn, you can really advance the freedom of many people, and you also become empowered in the way you view the system. So that's a very important point. I think the other point that I just want to kind of emphasize is this issue of genocide and how that is a framework that we really have to look at, because if you just look at these individual aspects of women's conditions in the prison, of the whole prison industrial complex, the conditions are horrible, they're barbaric, they're repressive, but they are for a purpose. I mean, it's not just accidental, in my opinion. There is a purpose, and the purpose is to really destroy the lives of people who this system that we have in this country really does not see as necessary. They're people that they really want to contain and put away. And I think that's a very important context. And then the increase in women, in particular, women are, in many ways, they are the community fabric. They tie together the families. They keep the community going. That's been true for African Americans since the time of slavery. So eventually, in order to really destroy a community, you have to destroy their women. And unfortunately, that is part of what we are witnessing. But we are not just witnessing it. We are really trying to expose it and support the change that has to happen. And that's another theme I just want to bring out is, you know, resistance of women inside is critical. That is the leadership. That is where we need to take our direction from in terms of women and resistance. But the women inside, they need the solidarity from people outside. I mean, this is not it shouldn't be a dismembered struggle or a one-sided struggle. This is needs to be our effort to be activists in solidarity with the women who are resisting and, of course, with the men who are resisting as well and exposing, because they are the ones who can be give voice to the reality. But then, you know, we have a not only a responsibility, but this is part of a general struggle of resistance in this country. I mean, if this country is incarcerating 2.3 million people, I mean, off the books, off the charts in terms of what the rate of incarceration is anywhere else in the world or anywhere in history. I mean, this has just never happened. You know, then it has to be central to our efforts to change what's going on. And personally, I feel like the economic collapse or whatever, what have you, in this, will only result in more severe incarceration and many different dimensions of incarceration, both from people who are going to take up dissent and resistance on the outside to what's happening, and then for all the other people whom the system will have even less reason to want to have, because there's not the workforce is obviously being reduced at a dramatically accelerated level. And part of what I think prisons are about is to, you know, warehouse and contain the excess population that there is no room for in this, you know, declining capitalist system. So so that's a larger view. Just in terms of my own work in history, I've been part of the California Coalition for Women Prisoners. I'm also part of the group that Vicki mentioned, Free Battered Women, and so have worked with women resisting within that framework for a number of years. The California CCWP has focused for many years on health care in women's prisons. And the way we actually were started was when women inside the prisons in California said the health care is essentially, I mean, they didn't use the term genocidal, but that's what they meant. It was killing people all the time. People were sentenced not to death. They were sentenced, they had discrete sentences, but they were being killed in prison because there was no health care. And so women said, we need to do something about this. And they approached an organization, Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, and said, we want to do a class action lawsuit about the health care. And LSPC said, okay, and they agreed to represent them. And then the women said, but we don't only think that lawyers and a legal strategy is sufficient. And we need a grassroots strategy to be complementary. And that was a great, wonderful thing for that recognition, in my opinion, because too often the legal strategy is divorced from the grassroots strategy. And in this case, they said, we really need a grassroots strategy, and so let's form an organization that will be the advocates, the grassroots advocates, and that can work with former prisoners, family members, and as well as people who are in solidarity and advocates. And so we formed the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, and one of our, founding principles was that we were going to have members of the organization on both sides of the wall, and not just, you know, be an outside organization. And so one of our founding member was Cherise Shumate, who was the lead plaintiff in this class action suit against the California Department of Corrections. And she was a woman who had sickle cell anemia. And she knew that the way she was being treated in prison, she was going to die there because of the way the lack of treatment she was getting for sickle cell. And unfortunately, she did die in prison in 2000. But she was determined that her experience was not going to just be a quiet death, and it wasn't at all. She She was the lead plaintiff in this lawsuit. She stood up. She became the voice of many of the other women who had a range of health problems that were not being cared for. And she was retaliated against. I mean, that's another aspect that I really want to draw people's attention to. If you stand up in prison, you don't just lose a little. People have total power over your lives. And, some people would say that Charisse's death was a result of retaliation. Very subtle. I mean, it wasn't like they just came in there and, beat her up and killed her. But, the kind of treatment she got or didn't get was definitely over the years. Was in some ways worse, although on the other hand, I think that there was a spotlight on her and they couldn't do things in the most obvious way. But that isn't to say that her role wasn't extremely important, and I think she said at the end of her life that she wouldn't have ever done it a different way. She was really, really glad for having stood up. The lawsuit did make some changes, and it brought the issue of healthcare in the women's prison told to the public. I mean, that was very important. There were changes that were made. Eventually, the lawsuit was settled. There were monitors who came in. It wasn't like a night and day change. I mean, that certainly, I could never say that, but I feel like the act of all these women, and Charisse was just one of a whole group of women who became very involved in both being members of this plaintiffs in the lawsuit, but organizing within the prisons. And that there is a video that's called Charisse Shumate Fighting for Our Lives, which CCWP puts out, which is kind of documents the struggle, which, if people are interested more, it's
really good.
It's a good video about resistance, and it's one of the few, I would say, videos that shows not only the conditions that women prisoners live under, but also the types of organized resistance that they have mounted. And I think it's so important that Vicky has written this book. I mean, and that there are different ways that people come and talk about the resistance, because that is the part that is that has totally disappeared. And all of the narrative of women in prison is, I mean, to the extent that it exists at all, is about abuse and about degradation and about suffering, which, of course, is part of it, but it's not true that people just accept this silently. I mean, all the stories that you've been hearing today, really are totally, in my experience, true and much more so. And, but part of the ability for the system to disappear those stories is because there isn't enough support on the outside. And so people don't even know the extent to which people are resisting. So a couple of other things I just want to mention.
Can I just add one
thing? Yeah, sure.
Just, I think it's really important. I think a lot of times at these conferences, people come and they hope to get ideas about how can we resist. Like, I was in a great workshop about Gaza yesterday, and people were saying, what more can, how can we have more effective demonstrations against the U.S. government's support of Israel, things like that. Well, if you read Vicky's book and if you watch that video, you get ideas. That's the other thing, is that the people who are in the most repressive situations can almost always teach people who are in, I can't remember what we used to call the minimum security right out here, how you can find new ways of resistance. You don't always have to have the same demonstration. It's a creative form that comes from the desire of human beings for liberation. And it can be a small thing, it can be a big thing, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. But it's another reason, I think, that could actually give some help to the movement on the outside.
Yes. Is this specific?
It's not specific. I just
okay. No, it's not quite open. I'm gonna wrap up in 2 minutes because we are gonna get to questions. Okay. So one thing I do want to be, besides Vicki's book, we put out a newsletter called Fire Inside. We've been putting it out since 1996. It's the only newsletter by and for women prisoners in the country that I know of. It's focused on California, but it really is. It includes other experiences. It could expand if there was more interest in doing that nationally. But we mail it out. We ask for a small subscription price, but you can pick up copies. I don't think I have enough for everybody because I couldn't carry enough things here. But so that's one thing. I have, if anyone hasn't signed up on the email list, we do also do a women prisoner news listserv. It's very low volume, but it does communicate about women prisoners. So that's another thing that people can become involved in. But, you know, people can do many different things. And I'll just end with one, you know, recent thing that we did where we had a big demonstration, a rally, where people from all over California came to the women's prisons and demonstrated in front of the prisons in solidarity, letting the prison, the guards and the people who work there know of our presence, letting the women inside know. And at the same time, the women figured out the ways in which they could express. I mean, they couldn't demonstrate. Laura can tell you, if you're organizing, that is automatically, I mean, that's totally illegal. If anything you do can be construed as organizing, then that's it for you and whoever has done it. But if you, there are ways of getting around it, because everywhere people get around those types of rules. And so the women wore ribbons. They wore ribbons in solidarity. They didn't go to their meals. Some of them sent us cards in advance that we put up all over the prison, outside the prison. So there were many different ways that we were able to work together with the people inside because we are in close touch with them. And that's another thing I would really say, that prison organizing, I feel like it has to be done with the people inside and with their direction. And I mean, you know, in terms of what they can do, what they need, what they want. And that's very important for people who are used to just doing things on their own, on the outside. But I think it's a really important thing, and that's how we are going to build a movement against incarceration in this country. It cannot just be done either from the inside or the outside, but it is a critical thing to look at and examine, and for everybody, I think, at this conference to think about in the future. And I know the people here in this workshop know that because that's why you're here, but I feel like it's something that I hope we can, all of us, communicate to the larger numbers of people in the left as one of the priorities for organizing in this period. So now let's have questions. Let's see. Well, I had cut you off, so when...
I'm Amy Schulder. I'm the editorial director of the Feminist Press, and I just want to make a comment and ask a question. And thank you so much, all of you. It's just so interesting. So my comment is that in October I'm reprinting Ann Jones's When You Kill, and it was a groundbreaking book in 1980, a history of how and why women in America have killed, and it basically tells a story of how women have mainly been incarcerated for violent crimes when they have done so in self-defense, and it was an important book in establishing battered women's syndrome in the courts. And I bring it up now because Ann Jones has done this really great research and has written a 10,000 word new introduction to it that does talk about and fill in some of these gaps about what has happened in the last 10 years for women, and kind of makes that connection between you know, the lack of social services and a safety net for women in our society, and how and why they end up, you know, killing usually, you know, almost always as a complete last resort, and when there are better services and a social safety net for these women, the level of violent crime, you know, against their intimates goes down significantly, and then factors like war and men coming home and the increase, extreme increase in male abuse of their female partners then contributes to this whole cycle. So my comment is just to say this book is coming out in October, and I'm looking for it. Ann Jones is brilliant. She's written, I think, really important, an important new piece to the story. It's been out of print for several years. And then my question, and I guess I'm worried and wonder about recidivism, and Laura and I have talked a little bit about like when and we hope that Marilyn's book comes out and what we can do for her. And I worry, you know, so much about how if the conditions of women, you know, put them in these, you know, it was the cause for their incarceration in the first place, that when they get out, you know, the chances are even worse now that they will find the kind of life that one needs in order to stay out of harm's way. So what can we do about that, and kind of think about in terms of our care and organizing about preparing, helping to prepare women who come out of prison so that they have some kind of support system, or, you know, how is that part of our work as well?
Well, I can comment briefly on it. I mean, there are different, I mean, all of it is just so less than what is needed, but there are some significant pieces. I mean, reentry is becoming a bigger subject, partly because the system realizes that if you have incarcerated 2.3 million people, some of them are going to inevitably get out, and there's nothing for them. So, so there are, I think, an increased interest in government approaches to that problem, which, you know, that's fine. There should be. There need to be. But in terms of activist approaches, I think there are there's also some things. I want to point out one organization which I think is very, very important. It's called All of Us or None, and it's an organization that was started 5-6 years ago now, which is all formerly incarcerated people, and it's dedicated to trying to ensure the civil and human rights of formerly incarcerated people. And that, to me, is the critical framework. Because the other stuff is important, but it's Band-Aids. I mean, what we need is formerly incarcerated people who will insist that the system respect them and change the framework for their lives. Because at this point, people can't vote in certain states, people can't get on welfare, they can't live in public housing, they can't get employment. I mean, so there is no, and that's legal. That's just the legal aspect of what happens when people get out of prison. I should let other people comment.
I just wanted to add to that, because if a family has Section 8 housing,
yeah,
and their son or daughter comes home after having a drug conviction, families thrown out.
Right.
So that's just, so the whole family ends up being punished.
Right.
And if that young person doesn't go home, then where do they go? So there are some programs right here in New York will do very good. Reentry Work Fortune Society is one of them, and the Osborne Association is another. Mm-hmm. They've been around for a very long time, but they can't possibly meet the need. So I actually encourage, all of us are not, does wonderful work, and one of the things that they do is they pool the voting power of the members of the organization, and they make sure that politicians understand that if they're not putting forth measures that will address some of these impediments to full citizenship, that they're not going to get reelected, or they won't get elected in the first place. And that, unfortunately, is the way America runs. And so we know the game, we have to exploit it. But the other thing I think is very important is for people to create new programs for people coming back into society on as large a level as possible. Because there's 2.3 million people coming out of prison. There's all the people, I don't even know what the numbers are right now, who are on probation.
Right.
But if you have a felony conviction, you face most of the same problems. And you can't get it. And there's less of an understanding of your inability to make it, because after all, you weren't locked up. Anyway, I'll stop.
I can wish
you
All right, let's see. You.
You want to hear all the questions?
What?
You want to hear several of them?
Hear several of them? I don't know.
Oh, whatever.
Okay. Let's just try and go through them.
Okay. I'll just be really good. Well, I've heard of that book. My name's Lee. I work with the campaign to end the death penalty, and I haven't read it. It was out before, right? In the press?
Yeah, 1980.
Yeah. So, I mean, because one of the things, I mean, you know, a number of women, not a large number, but a number of women who kill end up on death row. The women who are on death row, they're a high percentage of them are there for killing their abuser or killing their immediate family member. It's much more so than with men in terms of who you kill or who you, you know, direct a violent crime against. And people may, there's just a terrible track record of, in terms of women who've been executed, who've been, you know, like Eileen Wuornos is one of the most famous ones. I mean, she killed strangers, but in terms of a kind of disconnect with policy. But then, I don't know if people remember the case of Betty Lou Beats, who George Bush executed. She had been really severely, severely abused by her husband, and she was, and she was executed in, around shortly before George Bush ran for president. It was a really kind of despicable case. And so I wanted to kind of mention this organization, because this is also about resistance behind bars. I don't know if anyone here has heard of the DRIVE movement. It was started by a group of men on Texas's death row, but there's now this interesting thing where there's been a chapter formed in, coincidentally in Pennsylvania, the women's death row in Pennsylvania called Muncie. And you can go to drivemovement.org, and this is, it's an incredibly militant group of prisoners, and it's not large, and they are involved in all kinds of like civil disobedience, and you know, and I don't have time to get into all the stuff, what's like they have sensory deprivation in Texas's death row and so on. The issues in Muncie are some other sets of issues, like they don't have contact visits, which is particularly like an issue for women, you know, and not having contact visits is common on death row, but for women it's a particular, you know, because in terms of kids. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there and really encourage people to look into that, look into the campaign for contact which is connected with that. But it's drivemovement.org. Do people hear of Kenneth Foster, who won clemency 2 years ago? Very unusual case off the death row. He's one of the founders of DRIVE. And again, they're, you know, sort of revolutionaries and radicals who are very, and also a number of them are innocent and have their own fight. So please check that out.
This was just wonderful, and I just appreciate your courage and your bravery. I have so many questions. I'll just ask a few real quick.
And we have one for, just because there's so many people.
Well, I'll make one.
All right.
One thing we didn't talk about was the privatization of the prisons and the whole economic background of looking out at the most unincarcerated, constituencies and finding women and actually. You know, I'm not sure about the genocide, but certainly, I'm sure this is going on, but that's a profit, making thing to get more census in the prison to make more money. I wanted to know also about the, with their statistics on the prison deaths, but I want to tell you is Survival News, Survivors Inc., and I'm a representative of a paper for low and no income women, did a fabulous issue a couple of years ago on incarcerated women. We got a really lot of response to it because we found this incredible picture of a woman giving birth in prison in shackles. And we printed that. We did a lot of research. And we're working really hard on poor reform. And because so many, you know, poor women live in public housing and their children, and then they get kicked out. And I also want to tell you, for research, you want to check National Women's Studies Association, because I know they have some research on resistance in prisons. And thank you just so much for all your
work. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, back there.
I'm with the undergraduate student, John Jay.
Speak up a little.
I'm a graduate student at John Jay in the Criminal Justice Division, and with respect to the genocide question, I am trying to collect data, and not just numbers. Our esteemed counselor here had no problems getting numbers. You can imagine how many problems I have. Numbers exist, but I was already told by one DA's office in one borough in Manhattan that they're never going to appoint anybody to sit down and pull out the files and get the numbers from files. So what I'm looking for is incidents of misdemeanor to manslaughter bumps, both men and women, but my study is going to focus on women, and I would like to compare it to the numbers on men. With numbers, I'd be happy to get cases. Or stories of cases that I can use to support my study on this. This is now in terms of a person who doesn't believe in genocide. What happens with...
No, she didn't say that.
She said she didn't know about it.
Misdemeanor to manslaughter bump up takes a charge which would give you a sentence of under 1 year. And if someone dies in the process of your, let's say, stealing a bottle of milk, then you are responsible for that death, and you're bumped up to 25 to life in the state of New York, which automatically removes a female from the baby-producing population for her productive years. Not to mention causing the taxpayers in New York $1.25 million for housing her. That's an awful expensive forced birth control. So,
okay.
thanks. Anybody who wants it, I'll give you my email.
Okay, thank you. Back there?
I'll be fast. If any of you could also just speak briefly about immigration detention and its interaction with this system. Fast and growing, and yeah, my understanding is growing actually more rapidly, and is that is proving to be more lucrative for the privatized institutions.
Do you mind speaking?
What's happening now is ICE is at all of the jails. As soon as bail is set on someone, if they don't get bail from the courthouse, as soon as they show up at Rikers Island or any of the pre-trial holding facilities, ICE is right there, and they start interviewing people. And folks are terrified. They don't know that they can't answer the questions because they're not told. The fact that they have lawyers is irrelevant to ICE. And what's happened is we really have to educate. And fortunately, I will say to the credit of the Legal Aid Society and other public defender offices across the country, they're starting to get it, that they have to counsel their clients in the lockup not to talk to ICE because of the consequences, the severe consequences. You might beat the case and your client still gets deported just because of that interview. So that's another thing. The other problem that you find is that ICE, I'm sure, is in cahoots with all the public benefit agencies. So people who before had public benefits with no problem, ICE steps in and suddenly their public benefits are cut off.
Okay, the only other thing I just want to mention is that there are many women who are, and men, but I'm familiar more with the women, who they are in prison for many years on their state charges. They don't realize that, or federal charges, there are actually more immigrants who are in federal prisons, but, and then they are released, or they think they're going to be released, and immediately they are grabbed by ICE and put in detention centers. So there's a whole level of education that needs to happen, and legal representation. I mean, because of the way the laws are, unfortunately, there's very little you can do once you, if you have that felony and you've been spent all these years in federal prison. There's little you can do to avoid being deported or being put in the detention centers, but at least to know what's going to happen, to have legal representation that can help you is really important. And then with CCWP, we have a special project called the Compañeras Project, which does deal with women on the outside trying to act in solidarity specifically with immigrant women, so who are in prison. So that is... one just small little thing we try and do to pay attention to that particular issue. Other questions? I just want to, I know you have had a couple, and then I'll come back to you, people who haven't.
Just to comment in response, people who are not from New York City who are here, I live in New York City. I have seen little groups of ICE police at Port Authority down in the subway. And I see them a lot on the A-Train platform at 59th Street. They troll around in groups of about five people, looking for people to interview. And, you know, they're going to the immigrant, some people could be immigrants, whatever. And these people have no idea of their rights. Frankly, they have no rights.
Okay, here and then here.
Just a comment about the...
Can you speak up a little bit?
Stand up because we have a
thanks. Just, I work with... I work with immigration law, and a comment about the immigrants and detention and the criminal justice system. The issue of representation for people who are arrested for anything before they even get to any kind of hearing is extremely important, because what charges are initially placed against them and what they plead to can affect them dramatically, as far as whether they can be deported or have immigration charges against them. So the initial representation is the most important. But the issue of if somebody has federal charges against them or has been convicted is very, very complicated. So I wish that Joanne Macri had actually been here, because she could explain that very well. It's extremely complex. So somebody could potentially have a criminal conviction and not be have to be deported under the law, but it's just extremely
it's very,
complicated.
Very, right.
So that's why people really need really good advice.
Right, right.
Here's my question. I guess this is mostly for Laura, but I guess maybe you can answer this, but I was wondering what the disconnect is between working with a population that is, you know, like mostly minority, mostly from the lower class, coming out and working with like a movement that is mostly white, mostly middle class, mostly college education, quite frankly, to walk away from the thing they do as their work. Did you have this, like, really rethink the way you did activism when you came out?
Well, actually, for me, that was not quite that same problem, because as I said, I was a political prisoner, and so the community that embraced me was a lot of people who had been in the Black Panther Party and in the Young Lords. And but when I went to work at PAWS magazine, and I was going to say about Amy's question about transition, if you work someplace and you have anything to do with who gets hired, fight for them to hire people who are just out of prison. It's really important. It gives you stability, it gives you, you learn how to do things. I didn't know how to use a computer. But so I get there, and, you know, it was like night and day. And I actually used it when I worked in the village, and at my subway stop, there were these two guys who were panhandling one day. And I stopped, and I gave them a couple of quarters, and somebody started calling. I knew they were really interested. And I became friends with them, and used to, you know, we find each other every day and stuff, because I really needed to talk. It wasn't about race and class so much, although it was about class and it was about race. It was about who had been in prison and could share that experience. And it was very disorienting when I got out. There were all kinds of things going. My girlfriend who came in to bring me lunch could tell you that when I got out of prison, there were things, she would try to hold my hand on the street, and I would panic. Because in prison, you know, you can't do that, and a lot of things. But I think that that's a really good point, and I actually think at a conference like this one, I hope I'm not insulting anyone, I get furious at these conferences. When has the left forum had an ex-prisoner speak at their plenary? They didn't have something about Gaza either this year, which I thought they should. But when does the left as a whole say this is an issue of social justice? If we're against the system, people who are talking, some people that I know were talking about, okay, now Obama's in, how do we keep pushing a revolutionary agenda because he's going to be so cooperative and all this stuff, right, for actual, to try to recreate justice in this country around prisons and stuff. And you know, it's not fully answering your question, we can talk later, but I'll tell you, sometimes it would drive me crazy, and the thing that drove me the craziest and still does was people meet me, my sister's daughter was getting married soon after I got out, Susan and I go to the wedding. My sister was very close with the mother of the guy that was marrying my niece. And had told her, I have one sister, and she's been in prison. This woman knew there was one sister, and she'd been in prison. She meets me, and she says, well, what about the other sister, who's a sister who's in prison? I mean, she thought she had a sister who was not white and never pregnant, because the image of a prisoner. And, you know, and it's very hard for me, because I play on that sometimes, and educate people, but it's also hard because you don't want to sort of, I can't quite explain what I'm trying to say, but you don't want to just sort of say, oh, see, you don't know who prisoners are. Well, prisoners mostly don't look like me, you know, but the issue is that they are human beings who have every single human right that any other human being has, and if the left doesn't
Then
what are we fighting for?
Okay. I have one more question from Mr. Monica, and then don't leave because we do want to just have one couple of minutes of wrap up and distribute the stuff.
I have two comments. One is, with all the abuse she's put in prison, I'm going to share the courage to.
Well, what just walked out the door was one thing that gave me a lot of hope. The women here, although it's one I didn't know then. But I think human beings, I think you find a lot of survival techniques in them. You know this from the AIDS movement. You find a lot of survival techniques from the fact that you want to stay human. And then, you know, and I have to say, one, and anyone who knows me knows that I'll make a joke about anything. But when I was first arrested and I was facing at that point 78 years, I was sitting in my cell and I thought, okay, these fuckers, they may lock me up, they're not going to make me lose my sense of humor. And that was sort of my the other people I was with gave me enormous courage because I didn't have children. So I didn't have to worry about whether the foster parent was abusing my kid. I didn't have a lot of the responsibilities that I didn't have some of the tragedy. I didn't have a husband who had gotten locked up with me and then told on me and gave me the charges that he should have had. I have a friend who's still in prison, girlfriend crimes, we didn't talk about that, in the federal system, where there's a drug ring, and the head of the drug ring is a man. And he's made all the money, and he's told people to kill people. And his wife has taken a couple of phone messages. And then they get locked up, and because of the federal system, the way that you get your sentence cut is that you give up information, useful information. To give up useful information, get a sentence cut, you have to have useful information. Well, if you're the girlfriend, you don't know shit. You know who called you, that's the one thing, but if you're anyway. Those women were survivors. They kept laughing. They didn't lose their sense of humor. Now, this is not a blanket statement. There are plenty of people who the story, but I'm just saying, there is enough of that. That was inspiring. And, you know, I mean, I heard of a young man named Chase Boudin, whose parents, one got out of prison after 25 years, the other one is still in prison, on the radio the other morning, and Leonard Lopez was asking, wasn't it hard for you, that's a white middle class kid, wasn't it hard for you going back and forth to prison all those years? And he said, it was hard for me, and it's hard for the millions of other children who do that. And to me, that's the point, is that you're part of a world. And that world has to survive, and in order to survive, it has to. Right.
And then I just want to say something else that doesn't have to do with prison, really. I helped raise my niece, because my sister was a single parent. I raised her 3 days a week for 8 years. And I said to her, Melanie, you're a very special girl. And she said, what the big one said to me? I said, well, you're pretty than most, smart than most, and certainly more grown up than most kids your age. And she said, oh, okay. So she went to her school the following day, and she said to her, my Uncle Vinton, I'm special. She today works for the Ryan White Foundation in Connecticut. She works in the office 2 days a week and 3 days a week in the hospital for patients. I'm very proud of her.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you all for being an amazing, wonderful, wonderful people. Thank you all.